G'day, folks. Talk to Dominic Price and his occupation as a work futurist in his own right and with Australian-based tech giant Atlassian. Yarn about equitable workplaces, AI-based, human-based, distributed work team environments, and moral inventory. Trying to keep up with it all. The scary but exciting society that we live in when it's got to do with technology. Keep up the good work, brother. Love it. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. I want to thank our sponsors, Permanbil Australia, the greatest electrical chairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. It's a rider. Let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Righto. Mr. Dominic Price, thanks for jumping on the podcast for a yarn, brother, and all the work around being a work futurist, which I love that title. So, yeah, appreciate it.
Now, looking forward to it, mate. It's going to be a good chat today.
That's it. So, mate, in regards to work futurist, well, even before then, like before we get into that important work, talk to us about where life began for Mr. Dominic Price and sort of where it's led up to into that title. And there's going to be some other questions.
I like that question. So I was born in the north of England. I'm a Manchester boy, born and bred. Two older sisters, two younger sisters. Lived a very, what you would probably call now a very basic life, but kind of a fun life growing up. Like we had a ball and we had curbs to throw the ball at. Like that was our entertainment for years at a time, and simple family holidays, camping in a tent somewhere. And so it was always a very social upbringing. And it's fascinating because my work life is also very social. As in, I seek opportunities which involve people and involve connecting those people in fascinating conversations. The things that get me off in life are connecting two completely disparate people and seeing what they might create, right? Seeing what that spontaneity, that random conversation when someone goes, I'm from a completely different field to you. And you're like, yeah, like have that conversation and see what happens. And that's what led me to be a work futurist, is this view along that long and jagged path that, you know, that we spend so much time in work. I want work to be fun for as many people as possible. I want it to be playful. I want it to be enjoyable, not just a source of income. And I appreciate for a lot of people it is just a source of income. I don't have anything against that. But where it's not, if we can just add like one degree of happiness or enjoyment from it, we spend so much time doing it, I think that can have an outsized impact on how we think about our life as a whole. And so for me, the future of work is about what we can do today to make work and life infinitely better. And I think there's a huge amount we can do.
Yeah, 100%. And that's where you knocked it on the head when it's like 1 degree, you know, if you can at least slot that in and then that helps set a base foundation and you can work off that to, you know, sort of elevate the degrees as such. But so
I like to say to people, I'm not Bono from U2, right? I'm not trying to solve world hunger, and I don't have a superhero cape. But if I can impact a few people in that 1 degree, and then everyone else helps each other, then we've had that outsized impact already.
And could you see that, like, going back to, like, say there's certain, when you've gone to university, right, some of what you've learnt along the way. So if it's got to do with that style of, you know, when you've gone to uni and then you're taking in that information and that style of work, but because it interests me also because I've seen, like, looked at some of the work that you've done, and like I've done a bit of work with the Big Four when it comes to your Deloitte's, KPMG, EY, PwC, all of those. And I really get fascinated when I sit with some of these guys and just depending on some of the work that I do or that I've done and how we can channel that through consultancy and just seeing some of the minds, how they can work. So going back to some of what you've learned in uni and even going into some of the work, if you're going back to Deloitte's, is that correct? Done a bit of work with them. So was that a good sort of base and structure of sort of what's led into the work you're doing today?
Yes and no. It's fascinating. Like, I'm of the view that like every interaction I have gives me some net benefit if I can find it. Whether I enjoy it or not is a separate discussion, right? So if I look at like my time at Deloitte, did I love it? Sometimes it was great. Sometimes it wasn't. Did I loathe it? No. A lot of the time it's kind of in between. But did I learn a lot? Hell yeah. But for me, it was fascinating because for a lot of people in that environment, similar to university, the learning is what gets taught, right? I didn't learn much from what got taught at uni. I learned lots from my mates, from my friends, from interactions, right? I learned what it was to be an adult. Like, that wasn't sat in a lecture theatre at 10 a.m. on a Monday. That was like working with people and actually making mistakes and someone going, Dom, you can't say that or you can't do that. And it was similar in Deloitte. I mean, there was this huge amount of framework and structure and system in the piece of Deloitte. Did I learn a lot from that? Yeah, I learned a bit. But man, I worked with some crazy people, right? And I got to work on some crazy engagements with some crazy customers. And that's where my curiosity kicks in, right? Going from one institution to another and going, hang on, the thing that worked at this company doesn't work there. Like, why is that? I have this like fascinating amount of curiosity just to continually scratch, right? It's just like, there must be something behind that. And so the experience I learned a huge amount from, let's be honest, I could have been anywhere to have got that experience. So nothing against Deloitte, but for me, it's always around, what can I get from this experience, however good or bad the experience might be? And that mindset has really helped me say every interaction is a chance to learn something. Again, whether I like it or not is different, but it's always a chance to learn something.
That's it. And see, that I love that too. And I come from the same wavelength when it's got to do with lived experience out in the field. Mm. Like, it's good taking study here and there and what you can when you're talking about net benefit, but when you're out, when it's got to do with up at the coalface of situations, and even when you're dealing with crazy, whether it's good or bad or ugly, and taking those experience and then learning from things that go right and wrong, and just seeing the best and worst of people, but just how you can take advantage of situations for yourself, and you know, and when it's got to do with lived experience, and you grow from it. So,
I want to just dive on that lived experience that you said, because I think that I've got an example that really brought this to mind for me. I thought I had good lived experience, but after I left Deloitte, years after I left Deloitte, I actually joined a company that I consulted with when I was at Deloitte, and in the first week, a member of the team handed me all these reports, and I read them, and I was like, these are my reports that I wrote, and they're really utopian. And I'm reading my own recommendations that I've now inherited that I get to implement. And I'm like, dude. And so it was fascinating. I was literally the exact other side of the fence I'd been on. I'd written these reports and continually sent them to senior leaders going, I don't know why you're not doing this. It's so obvious. Why aren't you doing these things? Then I got them. I'm like, now I have to fix it. The lived experience became a real lived experience rather than a utopian one. And that's this balance that I'm always looking for in people, which is, it's easy to come up with a new framework and publish it and say, this is how the world should work. Mm. But what you just talked about with lived experience, the coalface is, here's how it actually works. And those two don't always collide in a nice, polite fashion, right? The framework looks pretty on a PowerPoint slide, but you're talking about the reality of humans, which are messy and scrappy and different.
100%, and it reminds me of even going back to, because before I was in a wheelchair, so because my background's in tier one construction, and some of the arguments that we've had with, so where theoretically you'd see what the engineers would have on a plan, and like, yes, that works in theory and on plan, but when you go when you're at the coal face and you're trying to physically build this thing, it's like, nah, we need to make changes here. And there'd always be that argy-bargy going back and forth. But you'd meet, you know, you still gonna make things structurally sound, but this is how it works in the real world.
Yeah, and so the kind of extension of that I've been playing in my career the last few years is, I think I've got a decent amount of empathy, but sometimes I need to go and do the job of the person I'm trying to help to truly understand it. And so my team, one of the things that my team have been practicing since we kicked stuff off probably like 6 or 9 months ago, I was like, we need to go and literally walk in the shoes of people we're trying to help. Otherwise, our suggestions are always going to be utopian in some regard because they're written behind a desk. So I need you to go to the equivalent site, go and see and feel. Right, and I use the F word a lot. I'm like, go and feel what it's like.
Yeah.
Right? And I was like, because it's easy to intellectualize it as, oh, good, yeah. And you write it down on a bit of paper, and on paper it looks like it makes sense. I'm like, forget the paper. How does it feel when you're in that environment? Right? And then I think we've got a level of empathy that we can genuinely help those people. But without that, I think you're just second guessing.
100%. And that's what you're doing there. It's not sort of up in the air, up in the cloud sort of stuff. It's really dragging on that empathy and those lived experience. And, you know, and then that's just building a more robust system for what you're doing. But so, and talk to us about, so when going back to bridges, what you mentioned, so you've some of the consultancy work and now bridging into this massive entity. And it's good to see it, like the work that you're particularly doing for you and on your own, but where that bridges into like Atlassian.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I'm pretty proud when I look at this mob and being an Australian organization.
Yeah.
And where it, and what they're taking on, because there's a lot of competition out in the world, what we see in the whole tech world, and I get really excited about it because there's a lot of stuff that doesn't mean to be accessible, but it is. And, you know, because me being a quadriplegic, I've got limited hand dexterity and stuff going on, and where I really depend on this stuff for myself, but where I can see it helping a whole lot of other people when it's got to do with general life work and everything else in between. So, yeah, talk us through this bridge to this massive Aussie entity.
Yeah, so it's a weird one, right? So I joined Atlassian 10 years ago. We were a tiny organization at the time. Most of my friends thought I was mad because I was going from large companies to ever smaller ones, and I think people thought I'd smoked something weird. And I was like, no, I want to go and be something small and crappy. I was in my 30s. I'm like, I can. Like, just selfishly, I can. So I'll give it a try. And if it doesn't work, I can always go back.
And that's a big call back then.
I'm like, when you get a chance to step forward, don't ask twice. Just step into it and you work it out. And so it's been a fascinating experience. There's a couple of things that I've learned in my time there, if I could give you like a high-level view. One is the importance of values. I remember looking at the Atlassian values before I even got hired. And there was just something that grabbed me inside, not logically, that grabbed me in the heart. And I was like, they could be my values, right? So open company, no BS. I'm like, yeah, I'm no BS. And like, play as a team. Well, I'm all about the team, right? And be the change you seek. I'm like, let's get on with it, right? And so I was reading them. And it was only then that I realized that in my previous career, there were two versions of me, Jake. There was a work version of me and a social version of me. And I've never realized how exhausting that was until I just became one version of me. And I was like, how freeing is this? How liberating is this? Just to be me, right? And it was weird. I'd never written that down on a plan. I'd never aspired to that because I never realized that I didn't have it. And then when I got it, I was just like, the weight off my shoulders, the freedom it gave me has been fascinating. And off the back of that, essentially what happened is quite early on in my career there, I realized that because I'm me, there's a Dom version of me, and then there's a whole lot of stuff I do in work. And the two aren't separate. They're actually beneficial. So you know, if you look at how that sort of morphed over time, one of the things that Atlassian's very passionate about is our foundation, right? We give 1% of equity and time, right, and revenue and products to charities around the world. And I get 5 days foundation leave a year. And each year, I push myself to do something incrementally better with those 5 days. The 5 days are fixed. I'm like, I want to get more than 5 days value. And I think each year it's got progressively better. And then this year, I was like, you know what? I have no shame in saying this. When I do public presentations, I charge between $25,000 and $35,000 for a public presentation. So I was like, you know what? Charities, not-for-profits, they can't afford that. They have the need. They want to improve how their teams work. They want to get thought leadership out there. They want to get better. They want to improve. They want stronger leadership. But they haven't got $25,000 knocking around. So I'm going to use my 5 days foundation leave this year all for not-for-profit activities. Right, so I put a blog out on LinkedIn and it went berserk, oversubscribed, right? And I'll do the same thing next year. But it's fascinating because I'm like, I never got permission to do that because I don't need to. And nor has anyone ever criticized me or challenged me on doing it. In fact, when Scott, one of our CEOs, saw it, it's like, that's a really good idea. You should share it with some of our other senior leaders. They should do the same thing, right? There's no policy in there. There was no approval. There's no permission. It's like, It's the right thing to do. Now, it doesn't benefit Atlassian. It benefits
That's awesome.
But it's that line of, is it the right thing to do? Yes, well, move on then. You don't need, you know, 5 tick boxes or sign off. It's like, it's the right thing to do. Crack on with it. So I'm doing 20 events this year. The net value of those 20 events is $500,000. And I'm doing that not for my benefit. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. And so when you're in the organization, when you have that sense of self and value and those values are aligned, suddenly everything becomes an opportunity to improve the world, right? Both because I'm doing stuff for Atlassian still. We're not a charity. We have to make money, do stuff for our customers. Our team playbook, so every time my team's focus is helping teams improve how they work. Every time we land on something, we publish it for free externally. Now, here's the weird stuff. Every time I do that, someone on LinkedIn or Twitter yells at me because they're upset giving away IP for free. Right? Yeah. And so it's one of those weird things in the world when you do push yourself out there, right? You've got to be ready to get a slap every now and then from someone who's just a negative Nora. But we're doing it because it's the right thing to do. And that's a great baseline for us of how we think about all of our interactions.
That's great. You know, having that, especially with the foundation and having that balance and, you know, where you're given that leeway as well. But the thing is, you're sort of reeling it back for what the foundation is and the essence of whether it's a foundation or Atlassian or just the actual work that you're personally doing and how that can sort of build into each other. And that's going to, you know, make your team grow. And just, you know, and with yourself. So when you're looking at work futurist,
yes.
So talk to me about, well, I love the word. So when it's got to do with work futurist and what that means, and because obviously looking into the future and when you got that DeLorean behind you, which is awesome, by the way, and just talk to us when you're getting in the DeLorean and you're just putting it on Mac 50 and you're looking towards a future of how you make it easier for yourself and the team that you're running and other people that you're involved with.
Yeah, so let me take you back a little bit in time, Jake, because I want to give you the honest answer here. So the title work futurist we made up for a joke. We did it to actually wind up one of my bosses, Scott. Now, the reason we did it was Scott had this thing where he said, when Atlassian was really small, he said, I don't care what anyone calls themselves externally. Like, that's not something that concerns me. Like, I'm concerned about, like, do we have equity internally? Are we equitable in the way we work? Are we fair? Do we have diversity, inclusion? I care about all those things. But if you want to call yourself, you know, quesadilla or fajita, I don't care. And so we were nurturing this new role, and one of the PR team jokingly said, like, work futurist. Now, I hated the title as well, but I said, you know who'll hate it even more? Scott. And I love why it's Scott. Like, I get genuine enjoyment from it. So we did it as a joke. The problem was a newspaper picked up on it and wrote an article that Atlassian had a work futurist. And I'm like, well, it's kind of stuck now. And so we kept it. The reason it's fascinating is at the time, it was actually nothing to do with the future of work. It was about saying what's happening in the workplace right now and is the future of work something we should be concerned about? And when we did, it was very technology focused. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, 5G, what's going to be the impact of tech and robotics. Weirdly, as we started to play in that space, I was like, you know what? They are all important. But you know what's missing from the whole conversation? Humans. The human part of work is the stuff that we've well and truly stuffed up, right? We go and hire, like the average organization I work with would spend like 8 or 9 months trying to hire the best person. And then they spend 3 months indoctrinating them into their organization, telling them that's not the way things are done around here. I'm like, why have you spent 9 months hiring a genius to turn them into an idiot? Like, why have you done that?
Okay. So
my belief, and it is a belief, I can't prove it scientifically, and I'm not that bothered by science anyway, but my belief is that the biggest problems we're having in organizations right now is human-based. And it's not individuals. It's when you get those individuals together and you say, work as a team, and they're like, oh, gosh, painful. Because, you know, I don't like the way Jake makes decisions, and I don't like the way Mary, you know, collaborates. And you're like, find an effective way of working together. And so everything that my team do now is how do we help humans work better together? Mm-hmm. Bizarrely, when the pandemic hit, like, there weren't many work futurists before the pandemic. Then every bugger became a work futurist. And I was like, this isn't cool, because I felt like I was cool before the pandemic because it was rare to be a work futurist. And then everyone started talking about the future. So I've changed it. I'm still called Work Futurist, but my focus has changed. I would say the last year, literally everything I've done is about modern work. It's like, what are we struggling with today? Not what might happen in 2030. What are you struggling with now in 2023? And what one thing we can do as a team today to make that 1 degree better? Right. So instead of talking about, you know, time horizon 3, we've brought it right back into today. And it is all baked in pragmatism. It's like, what can we action-oriented do right now to improve how we work? And if it doesn't work, what's the next thing we're going to do? It's small, it's scrappy. But the thing is, when you start to address that stuff, it doesn't feel like you're building anything majestic, but you're building lots of little bits of momentum. And so right now, my entire passion, I'm like, I'm done with the future of work right now because it's all thought leadership and it's just all fluff. I want practicality. So it's all about modern work right now.
That's great. So, and with the work that you're doing at the moment, so is it, when you're looking at the different facets between humans and tech and AI, machine or AI, machine learning, is it getting easier or harder? Because I'm seeing where we're trying to make things easier, right, in the, when it's got to do with tech, but then it's always hard managing people.
That's the thing. Every time a new technology comes along, we get all excited. You're like, I still have to manage these same people on Monday morning, right? And that's the bit that's still hard. Like, ChatGPT can write my blogs for me, but I still have to do a performance review for a human.
Yeah, that's right. So, because personally, like, we've got, like, with the work we do, we've got teams of people, and it's always a tricky thing when, because sometimes you might have too many chiefs and not enough Indians, and all of that sort of stuff, and you got to just get that balance. So, which
so, Jake, let me talk to you about that, right? Because one of the things we're doing right now is exactly that. It's exactly that, right? So, we're shipping in April, at end of April, we're shipping a pack, and in this pack is, we did a huge amount of research over the last few years, and when we actually sort of analyze the research, what it shows is, one of the biggest barriers for successful teams right now in modern work is shared understanding.
And you're like, spot on.
Shared understanding. Right? And you're like, but hang on, that's like really simple. And you're like, no, it's really simple. It's not very well done. Mm-hmm. So when you unpack that, it's roles and responsibilities, right? So you see the Indians, like who's playing what role? It's around, do we have the same shared understanding of why we're doing this? What's our purpose? Mm-hmm. It's how we're actually going to work as a team. What are our goals? How are we going to work? Are we all on Slack? Are we going to email each other? Are we doing pages? Do we want to do meetings? Or are we async? What are we working on? Like all the very simple but very hard to do human stuff. And then the fourth element is, who are the other teams that we need to work with and what's our relationship with them? Now, we've shown with our own teams internally, we solve those four things. Those teams are flying. We don't solve those four
things. That's awesome.
You have the smartest people in the team. And it is like dragging yourself through quicksand, mate. And you're like, how is it that when I put intelligent people together, it's so hard? It's because the system isn't working for them. And so we're launching that pack in the next few weeks, free of charge to everyone in the world, our team playbook to say, if you're either forming a new team or you're an existing team and you just want to sense check how you work together, do these four things, right? And when you do them, honestly, everything elevates. Your mojo comes back. Now, it's sometimes hard because you're like, I thought I was a chief. Mm. And it turns out on this one, I'm not. You're like, hey, it's better to know. If you know you're not a chief, like, play the role you're meant to play, not the one you want to play. And so for us, it's just been an absolute game changer in elevating those conversations, which are every single one of them is a human conversation. If we get that human bit working, technology is a great amplifier. But if that human bit doesn't work, technology just feels like a heartburn.
That's it, because at the end of the day, it's our fingertips that are writing the code and doing everything else.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then the machines do learn, but, you know, they're not people. They don't work like us, think like us. Things may be getting close in certain aspects, but it will still never be humans at the end of the day. So have you had any, when you're looking at, with the work you're doing, some inspirations, who's been some inspirations to yourself and some people that have helped mold you today?
It's a good point. I made the mistake a few years ago of looking for inspiration in probably too obvious a place. And actually all I got was confirmation bias. And confirmation bias is weird because it feels really good for the ego, right? So I go and listen to the presenters and I'm like, I agree. I think the exact same as you. How amazing am I? And I'm like, hang on, I'm living in a vortex here. This isn't learning. This is confirmation. My ego doesn't need a massage. So I set myself a goal to find very orthogonal content that would really provoke me and just make me feel a little bit uncomfortable. Quick example, a good mate of mine, Dr. Andy Walsh. Andy is a high-performance elite, used to run ski teams. He used to work for Red Bull with their elite athletes. Like, he is the guru of elite human performance. He had a gathering a few years ago, and I met a guy called Moran. Moran is a neuroscientist, and he's talking about dream management. And I'm like,
wow.
So he does an entire, like, 45-minute presentation about dream management and the impacts on brands, advertising, memory, like a whole stuff. And you're like, no, this is sci-fi, right? And he's like, no, here's what we've done in dream management. Well, there's another lady talking about how they've been using virtual reality neuroscience to reprogram the brain so that you don't feel pain. So they're taking people that are like, I've got a really sore arm.
That's
when I
wrong.
Do this, my arm really hurts. And they put this kit on their brain. They get them to do that motion in their head, but not move their arm. They don't feel pain. So the pain is reduced. And you're like, whoa. So the brain is a sponge, right? And the show is how we rewire it. And then the final one, just because it blew my mind.
Pharmaceutical companies won't like that with all the opioids cruising around.
There you go, right? But this is why I like this stuff, because you go and do it and you're like, well, why is that not mainstream?
Yeah.
For that exact reason.
Because we only use 10% or 11% of our brain, so.
But we don't want to tap into that. Now, society might, but the capitalist system doesn't want to tap into that, because those pharmaceutical companies make a lot of money, pay a lot of tax, and they maybe build bridges and roads. And don't, like, you suddenly get into this hard trade-off. The final one that was truly fascinating for me, they took a pilot, put him in a simulator with an MRI scanner on his head, and he landed the plane. He's landed the plane a million times. But he's in the simulator, he lands the plane, but they record every pulse of his brain landing the plane. They reverse the pulses and they put it on your head. You've never flown a plane in your life and you land the plane.
That is wild.
And I'm watching this and I'm like, that's not true. And they're like, no, here's how it works. And you're like, no. So I do that equivalent thing with climate and sustainability. I'm doing it with some First Nations people. There's a huge amount to learn there. The animal kingdom. I'm doing a lot with the zoo right now because I think there's a huge amount we can learn from nature. I just pick these things and I'm not going a little bit away from my role. I'm going wholly away. And I'm not trying to even bring it back. I don't sit there at the event going, how's this relevant to teamwork today? I don't. I just let it sit and I let it fester and nurture. And at some point in time, weeks, months, years later, it pops back up in my body and I'm like, ah, that's why I was there. That's why I learned that thing.
Mm.
It was irrelevant on the day and I let it be irrelevant. Let it stay irrelevant, but let it sink in there and be uncomfortable.
God, that's a lot going on. Like, that's so exciting for the future. No, but there's so much human potential. So when it comes to, you know, what we use upstairs, so yeah. – Brother, I want to go into, and it sounds great with all the different mobs that you're working with. Like, you know, I'm proud Wanneroo Kamilaroi man, so it's good to hear, you know, getting in the First Nations space and, you know, when it's all about closing the gap and, you know, where we are sort of increasing forward in some sectors and not with others, but it's good that things are starting to elevate and we've got social media and, you know, a strong presence where everybody can start broadcasting their voice and be heard. So.
Yes.
And what should be heard, I'm really interested in, it is moral inventory.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
That's very intriguing.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So let me just set the context, because I'm sure you've got, but maybe your listeners haven't. So in 2020 was a weird year for me. I got diagnosed with early stage bowel cancer, had surgery, had 75% of my bowel removed. And before then, thought I was invincible, and then suddenly realised that. Well, as we all have a moment in life when we go, I felt invincible. Now I'm not. Right, the reality kicks in, and then within weeks of that, my sister, who's also my best friend, passed away from breast cancer. Right, she'd been sick for 6+ years back in the UK.
Sorry to hear that, brother.
Yeah, thank you. I was fortunate enough to get back to the UK. And spend some time with her, and you know, I was there with her when she passed, which is huge, right? You don't want someone to go alone, and so that was important for me. But off the back of that, I spent 2 weeks in quarantine when I got back to Sydney, right? It's in the middle of the pandemic, alone in a room by myself, right? A couple of weeks after I've had my own brush with death, and matter of weeks after I buried my sister after her long battle with cancer, and just sat there going, what is the point? Like, what is this all about? Like asking those fundamental questions, just doing it alone, locked in a room when you can't even open the window. And I suddenly realized one afternoon, either this spirals me down, and this is the thing that takes me out, or I find some way of making this a platform that I build upon. And it was dark at the time, mate. I was struggling to find the light in there. But when I did, I was like, you know what? It's about balancing life, right? And so the concept of the personal moral inventory was something that I'd noodled on before, but I started to write it down, and I'm like, okay, how would I score myself? How would I, like, if I look back at the last few years, how would I score myself? And when I looked at what I was doing for work, I was all in. But I was chasing this fictitious dream. I was chasing the fictitious nth dollar, right, that made everything all right. Because once I've got that much money, I'll be fine and I'll be comfortable. And I was chasing all this stuff and productivity, and I need to do more. I want to be more. And I'm like, why? And then when I looked at that and I scored it against people, like how I was looking after, I wasn't looking after myself properly. And I wasn't investing in relationships properly. When I looked at planet, right, flying around the world, everything in life was disposable. Because I'm chasing this dream, everything became a transaction. I'm like, that's not
cool. True. It's easy to get lost in that stuff.
So easy. And then I'm like, what's my purpose? Like, why am I doing this? And I think my purpose for me is a great anchor, where I'm like, if I can see some North Star and directionally I'm comfortable with it, it sets me on a path. But if I've not got that North Star, I could go left or right and everything seems okay. And that's when I tend to get a bit lost. So I'd written it down and I was like, you know what? If this is a thing for me, it might be a thing for other people. So I was very fortunate that the team at TEDx, who I know really well, they've been looking to get me to speak for a few years, and their theme that year was raw. And when I spoke to the organizers, I was like, okay, raw, I can do raw. And they were like, are you going to talk about the future of work? So you know from my content, they just assumed I was going to talk about the future of work. And I was like, nah, I could do that any day of the week, anywhere in the world. I want to talk about something different and personal. And so I did my first rehearsal the day before the live event with the team from TEDx. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house. And they were like, just do that. Just go on stage and do that. So for me, it was this wonderful moment of being able to draw a line in the sand, celebrate my sister's life, celebrate the realization I'd had, and go, life starts again today. Like, you've got a second chance. Life starts again today. And if I think about my life since then, it's completely different to my life before. Not in a better or worse, just completely different. But, like, you know, I've been in, a quick example, I've been in lots of, like, really short-term relationships because I was chasing productivity. I was flying around the world. I was gung-ho. Like, I'm here and there and everywhere. But like, where's that balance in life? Not only have I got myself a girlfriend that I'm now engaged to be married to, but we had twins last year. We've got two twin boys at home, 7 months old.
Good
right?
stuff.
Right, so now I'm a dad. And I'm like, right, so now I redid the moral inventory because I'm like, okay, well, I've had life event changes now. So now life has changed. I need to reassess because when I returned from paternity leave, I had 10 weeks paternity leave when the kids were born, and I got back to work. I really struggled. I was like, oh, what am
just
I?
Just trying to find your feet again?
Trying to find my feet. But it wasn't just like a few degrees out here, a few degrees out there. Everything felt different. I'm like, no, I'm a dad now. That's my job. And here's the list of things with being a dad. But I'm also a partner, so I'm still a boyfriend. And I'm a worker, and I'm like, oh, there's too many things. They don't fit into 24 hours. And I want to excel at all of them, Jake. I want to be amazing, and I'm like, I can't be. So suddenly I felt like a failure because I didn't think I was doing a great job at any of them. And so I was like, right, time out. I need to do a rebalance. And so this isn't about criticizing myself. I use the personal moral inventory to go, if life around me is changing, and it always is, how do I make sure I'm investing sensibly? Because there's only 24 hours in the day. There's never going to be any more.
Yeah, that's tricky. Just finding those, you know, and now you've got some twins in the equation and being a dad. So that's another layer of just being a human and trying to provide and then having those multi-layer systems. And it's just trying to find balance. Like, I try and do it for myself too because I get too bloody lost in work, and it's just tricky. So it's good to hear those different when it's got to do with moral inventory and just finding levels and percentages of what you should give to work, to family, to being a partner.
And just the nuance, and my realization was that it wasn't that I wanted to stop doing work. When I first did the Pistol Moral Inventory, I was like, my goals for the next year are all about work-related stuff, and I'm already doing really well at it. So if I'm at 95% and I'm placing at 96%, if that's what I want to be, but if I was to score my friendships right now, they're at about 50%. So why don't I invest a little bit there instead? So it's not about taking my foot off the pedal at work. It's about saying, continue what I'm doing in the work context. That's going really well. But if I've got notional time, if I've got discretionary time to invest, let's invest it in health, right? My own personal and mental health and my friendships, meaningful friendships. And actually the weird thing is when those friendships improve and I got my mojo back, my work improved. Right? Everything actually improves, right? It's not like improve one and nothing else happens. They're all interrelated. But having that balance of going, where am I choosing to invest? And the realization that it doesn't happen to me, it was my choice where I invested.
Yeah, true. And talking about investing, because you're seeing a lot of people when it's all having a crack at open source and AI, right? And now you're seeing the massive boom when you've got ChatGPT and just how powerful that bloody thing is. So what's your thoughts on that and the investment in it, like the people power, and obviously there's a lot of machine learning and it's growing at a rapid pace, but thoughts on it and where it's going?
Yeah, it's a fascinating one, right? If you look, artificial intelligence, machine learning isn't new. They've been around for a good while. What they were both searching for, same as you could put in this camp, you could put metaverse, Bitcoin, right? You could put the whole sort of project. What they're searching for is a compelling use case. When everyone goes, I get it now. And for years with AI machine learning, it was lots of little stuff, but you're like, it's nice. None of it was groundbreaking, right? For me, I used to work a lot with our recruitment teams, and every software vendor was selling artificial intelligence that would screen candidates for you and take out any biases. And you're like, okay, that's good. Really groundbreaking? Maybe not, right? And so basically AI was doing transactions. Suddenly, with ChatGPT, it's kind of version 3 or 4 where it first came out, you're like, this is going to impact entire jobs and entire communities. And that's because we finally found a use case. Right? We found a use case where it's similar to like when Google came out. Like it wasn't like we were all sat around before Google got invented going, I hope someone invents a better search engine. The search engines that we had were fine. It's just Google came out, we're like, that seems even better, right? And so we're not always demand the thing until you see it and you're like, damn, now I see it, right? And that's what ChatGPT is effectively done. It's shown as a set of use cases that are very compelling, mainly because dollars, right? You go, well, if I have to hire a whole squadron of humans to write this content and the content I still have to review in his average, or I stick it into this machine and it turns it out in 3 seconds for free, you're like, So actually what we're seeing now is business application of artificial intelligence machine learning to surface more insights and intelligence. And that stuff is where you've got to get excited. Now, here's the trick. What I hope for, Jake, and this is genuinely a hope, not a belief yet. I hope that we use things like ChatGPT and artificial intelligence to surface insights quicker that me and you look at with our human brain and go, okay, here's how I might think about this in the world. And here's how I'm going to apply that insight. I always hope we have that human intervention for the time being to go, what would be the impact of making that change? Rather than saying a machine has decided that X should happen. That's my concern.
Yeah, that makes total sense because it's, you don't want to be too far removed from it. So, these things are, moving away from really how we think and feel and where it's making the calls, but going back to, it's crazy when you go back to see, the Industrial Revolution and you're looking at the labor force and where people, and I've heard you say it before, where people are the machines, right? So, but over time, things have changed. So when you're looking at AI, do you think people, and you're looking at the certain jobs and sectors, do you think people should be worried?
Yeah. I think if people should be worried if they aren't reskilling and they aren't adapting themselves. If someone sat there saying, I've done this job for X number of years and I've only got Y number of years left till retirement, and if I just sit here, I'll be okay, I'm nervous for them, right? I'm nervous for me. I'm 45, so I'm not near retirement in my mind.
Spring chicken.
I've got 20 odd years experience of doing something, but is that thing still relevant? So for me, my goal in the last few years is how do I continually develop myself and learn new skills and adapt them so that I'm moving with the time. So I've not become the anchor that slows everything down. So I think if people are awake and they put the blinkers out and they're adapting their skill set, I think that there's net roles there for everyone. But I worry about the people that are like, no, this is my thing and this is what I do. And they're the ones that I think are going to be sort of painfully disrupted.
Yeah, it's going to be, you know, it's interesting. Well, I love seeing all this stuff, but then I think of the broader value of whether that value is good or bad and depending on the sectors, because obviously you've got a lot of humans that are in certain sectors and your jobs get stripped away. But then it's always been about continuous change and where we're going to try and learn and adapt and roll with it and take advantage and try and stay on your toes so you know what's going throughout the world and how you keep up with the rest of it, because you know change is inevitable no matter what sector you're in. And
one area I think we need to really call out though, mate, and this is again I hope is the moral side. So if you go I'm going to get this one wrong, but it was the 30s or 40s. I think it was Renault. It's 50s or 60s. There's a car company invented the first airbag. And it was invented by a group of male scientists because only men worked in scientists back then. So they built the airbag, they tested it, it was awesome, and it got deployed. In the first few accidents, men were saved, women and children were injured.
What?
Because the airbags were tested only on men, certain height, certain weight. Right? So we accidentally built bias into airbags. So you're like, oh, that's all right. It's like 50s or 60s, forgivable. You go to the like late noughties when Google rolled out Picasso and their photo editing software, the first version of it, which they tested internally, when they released it externally, and it found African-Americans, it identified them as baboons. Because when they tested it internally, they didn't have any African-Americans in their population. And so, and that wasn't bad intent. They tested it. But when they released it, that's what happened. We run the same risk now, right? If we've got this small cohort of people that are designing and building the logic into this stuff, and it's not diverse and inclusive and balanced, that logic stays, right? But instead of it impacting 10 or 20 people, it's now 10 or 20 million people. Right, because we're going en masse with our deployment. And so that's the bit where I think morals are even more heightened and even more important than ever before.
Yeah, true. I hope it does. And you going back to that when it's like having the male to female, this is just something that irks me. It's got to do with, you know, the Australian building code, like AS1428, when it's got to do with all accessibility, right, and where most of it is honed on individuals in manual chairs. Not so much electric chairs for myself, so it's not taken in that width, that length, and got to do with the circulation space. And it's okay, people, catch up. The world's changing. So when you're talking about bias and everything else involved, absolutely spot on. And when you're talking about change, so New South Wales government has just come into play. They've just recently won. And when you're looking at Labor, pretty much the whole country except for Tasmania, when it's got to do with different states and territories. And now you've got the federal government also that's in power as Labor. So when you're looking at that side of the government, right, how do they assist and are they friends when it comes to assistive tech or when it's got to do with AI, when it's got to do with some of the work that you're involved in, whether it's got to do with some of the charity foundational work, and is it a bit of iron sharpens iron there, or they're still got to step up to certain equations? How does that sort of mold into place if it does at all?
I think it has to. I think the struggle for any federal or state-based government recently has been short-termism. Like, I can dig some stuff out the ground and we'll make some money. You're like, no, you can, right? And we've got the big four banks and they'll continue to print money and house prices will go up and everything will be fine, right? And you're like, no. At some point, we need to invest in future economies. If you look at our export basket, it's very old school, right? You know, coal, metals, minerals. And you're like, oh, we've got those natural resources, but are they going to exist forever? And where are we investing in future industries so that we can be a net exporter of great future stuff, right? And if you think about it, the best example I've seen so far is electric vehicles and batteries. Like, huge amounts of the material that go into batteries is mined in Australia, shipped somewhere else where it's manufactured, and sold backwards as a really expensive battery. And I'm like,
Isn't that insane?
Hey, but you don't have to, and it's like, I'm not saying people go fix that. Maybe that's been and gone, that ship may have sailed. But if we look at the future around climate, right, and around sustainability, and there's a whole of industry that you could look at and go, Australia could outcompete if we can invest for the medium and long term. The problem is we love short-term returns, right? And so I think that's hopefully, right, that whichever government gets a grip of this and says, you know what, we're going to do this properly to build something that's sustainable. That's the thing that needs to change. Whereas, I mean, I've lived in Australia for 20 years, you know, UK before that. Unfortunately, most governments think the same thing. I need to do enough now to stay in power. I need to do enough right now to get voted back in. So they want to get voted back in. I'm like, I kind of don't care whether you get voted back in or not. I just need someone to stick around long enough to deliver a long-term plan, right? And if you look at it, even a lot of the debate around infrastructure, right, whether it be roads, right, or transport in some regard, you're like, that stuff takes years and years to work out and years to pay back. And if you chop and change every 4 years, you're never going to get started, right?
And so the money gets stripped from one area to the next.
So the comical example for me, right, so I live in the North Shore of Sydney, right? And so for years there's been the whole debate about a link from the northern beaches into the city. And it's like, do we add another lane to the bridge? Do we add another bridge to the tunnel bridge? Do we change this? Do we add a tunnel? Every single time. And it's been debated, I think, since the late 90s, when that strip of road was at capacity in the 90s. So you're like, it's still not fixed, and it's still a political argument. I almost don't care which one you do, but as a set of policymakers, at some point, can you do something? And so this is the bit where I think politics gets in the way of politics. It's like, you are here to serve your community, but not just in the short term. I think if we just dial it up a little bit and think medium term, long term, Australia could outperform on the international scale. But I've not yet seen the appetite from anyone to do that.
Yeah, let's bring some of the jobs back here and also what you're talking about, because it is insane when you're looking at, you know, the Northern Beaches or the North Shore. And, yeah, you've got train lines going certain areas, but there needs to be a lot of improvement. When you look at other countries and how they, you know, whether it's got to do with tunnels or bridges on top of bridges, and it's like, you know, every 4 years or how many years, let's just settle on a plan and just let that structure go throughout the next however long it takes to build these bloody things, you know, instead of – every couple of years, let's move the money around and everybody's got their own ideals. It's like, let's just make logical sense for the people of the future. And you being a work futurist, that's where they should be grabbing your ear, mate, so you can have a yarn to them.
There's some good conversations. I had some great conversations in the past with Victor Dominello. He did some great work with the digital part of New South Wales, phenomenal work there with Ed Husick. Ed's fascinated and passionate about investing in future tech and bringing jobs back to Australia. He wants to be a net importer of roles where we can and getting the brain drain that left Australia back into Australia and growing teams around it. So we're seeing momentum there. It's just, it's going to take a couple of brave souls to put the money down. And I think once they do, then we can build momentum. And I think everyone will be happy afterwards. Everyone will claim that they had the idea afterwards.
100%. So you're looking at FB, the metaverse. So you're going to see other organisations getting in on this, right? So where do you see, when it's got to do with virtual reality and also augmented reality, do you see a workspace evolving in that sector?
I think we think about it incorrectly. I think we think about it in verticals when we should think about it as horizontals, right? So Facebook will go down the avenue of going, everything's going to be virtual. You're like, okay, it's not. And then you go to the old school banks, right? And they're like, nothing's virtual. I'm dragging everyone back to the office. It's 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. You're like, well, that feels wrong as well. So my sense is it's somewhere in between. But the mistake we keep on making is we're trying to pick out exactly which scenario is the answer without realizing that the answer for me is different than the answer to you. You might want to work from home 3 days a week. I might want to work from home never, right? And it's not that one of us is right, one of us is wrong. We're both right. It's what works for us to get the job done. Mm. And so it's the same for AI, virtual reality, all that jazz. You know, will it take over the world and will I work in a virtual environment forever? I don't see that. There's always going to be office space, and therefore What role does it have to play? So there's some organizations I'm playing with where I'm like, we're going to have distributed teams, whether you work from an office or you work from home. We're always going to have this distributed work environment where, Jake, for me and you to chat today, we couldn't physically be in the same room. So you're like, cool.
That's right.
How does technology help us build a better connection? That's a great conversation to be had. But if you lived down the road and we had a shared space we could go, we would have just gone there. We didn't need virtual reality. So try to work out what role it plays. And then when it does, what's the problem that it solves? Which I get a little bit peeved by all the advertising for Meta, because I'm like, it's all about revenue generation and marketing. And I'm like, that's what's the problem is it solving? And if someone said to me, in a distributed world, this technology will help you build better team cohesion, better psychological safety, a higher sense of belonging, and therefore you have more psychological safety, you're going to work better as a team, I'm like, oh, I'll buy that. I want to buy that. I want to buy a better team environment. Mm. I don't care what the technology does. The technology is superficial. So I almost think with a lot of this tech stuff, we just need to pause and go, let's fall in love with the problem first, like genuinely fall in love with the problem and know what we're solving for. Then let's look at the solution.
Oh, mate, and you're spot on. Psychological safety, that gets lost a lot by a lot of organizations, and that's really important because people can get stripped of their mental well-being, you know, if they're not going down the right path depending on the tech, and you know, over time it's not good. So it's really good.
No, they can get swallowed. Oh. They can get swallowed up, and also the further apart we are, like the more distant, it's harder for me to sense, right? If we're working together but we only have 1 hour Zoom chat a week, it's really hard for me to sense how you feel. But like we're in the same environment and I see you every day, I'm like, hey, you know, Jake doesn't see himself, like, let's have a chat. But so we're losing that data point, which is dangerous, because that sense is really important for us to intervene and say, hey, are you okay? Is there anything we can do? Like, how can we help you? Rather than waiting until you're at the bottom of the cliff and like, that's too, I don't want to fix it when it's broken. I want to prevent it.
That's right. It's putting everything in place so you've got contingency and healthy individuals. Yeah. So where do you see Banner Worth Futurist, say, 10 years from now? Where do you see the working environment? Yeah, I know that's long-winded, but no, if you can compartmentalize it.
Yeah, it's a good time horizon. I think on the whole, we will have done away with the Monday to Friday 9 to 5. I think we'll be working a notional 40 hours for the majority of people, but it won't be this office hours construct anymore. I think we will have improved the muscle of asynchronous work, where we package stuff up and we work in different time zones, but we do so with like neat handovers, right? So we don't all have to be online at the same time to talk. I'm hopeful that if we've taken some of the mundane work away through ChatGPT, we've taken some of the grunt work, that we're actually as humans getting to do the things that are uniquely human, right? The vulnerability, the empathy, the authenticity, the creativity that we have, the way we can spark each other in the conversations. And then I'm really hopeful that we've had an impact on the things we're talking about today that frustrate the hell out of me, right? So climate, sustainability, diversity, equity, inclusion, you know, the gender pay gap, all these things that we're talking about is important, but I'm like, why are we talking about it? Like, if we've got all this tech and all these tools and there's all these smart people and all this money, why aren't we addressing them? They don't feel impossible. Like, I'm not saying it's completely, I think there's like, but meaningful progress.
Yes.
And so for me, at that 10-year time horizon, we need to have got off the pot, right? Because we're dabbling around with these topics. And I think there's a lot of organizations, you know, do the greenwashing. Oh, it's, you know, it's Pride Week, so everyone's going to be a rainbow. And you're like, hey, come on. For the other 50 weeks of the year, we know you don't care. So like, how do we make that stuff authentic? Mm. The one way of doing it is to follow through and take action. And I'm hopeful in that time frame, on at least some of those big items, we've made a good nudge there. We've made a difference.
Authenticity. And mate, I really appreciate yourself, but like when it talks about authenticity and just the reality of, you know, what's happening now and what we're looking down in the pipeline. But brother, I really appreciate your time for jumping on and having yarn. Is there anything else that you'd want to sort of throw up in the atmosphere?
If anyone who listens in on your podcast is struggling with teamwork, we ship a whole lot of content free of charge. Don't pay anyone to get better at how you work as a team. So if you're struggling with anything, Jake, I'll send you the link for our team playbook. You can stick it in your show notes. That will is do. Free content for anyone to use anywhere in the world. You don't have to be a customer. You don't have to pay me anything. Just the little techniques to get better at how you work as a team. And I think if we all do that and sign up for what you said before, mate, that 1 degree at a time, we can make the world a better place.
Teamwork. Love it. So if people want to get in contact with you via socials or wherever it may be, throw those links out in the atmosphere, mate. Yeah. Where can they get you?
Yeah, hit me up on LinkedIn because that's the place where most of my conversations occur. Mm-hmm. And that's where Jake reached out, right? And as you know full well, you drop a man a ping and he pings you back and you start a conversation. You never know what might come of it. So if you don't message, you definitely don't get a reply. But if you do, you never know.
Beautiful. Righto, Dom. Love your time, brother. And I look forward to seeing some of the great work that you're doing now and in the future.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to help.
Oh, why is Siri, my watch, talking to me? God. See, folks, solid yarn, eh? When we're looking at, as individuals, as teams, trying to optimize ourselves, drawing on the strengths of technology in the fabric of our society, because that ain't slowing down. It's only picking up momentum and growing at a really fast rate. We've got to keep up with it. So it's trying to put those steps ahead to know what's coming as best as we can. And seeing Dom going through his struggles personally and with his family, not always easy, and forging ahead. And with that Atlassian, no joke, that mob. And it's good to see that there's companies like that within Australia. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe or follow button. And we've got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. So if you want to roll with the squad and become a patron, that'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at streetrollandcheater or email one word, streetrollandcheater@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs. So check it out. And I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they got great assistive tech also. So righto. See you on the next one.